Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, July 19th, 2002, and Wanda Diefeldt does a session, Church and Politics. And this is tape number DEW 2002-04. So let's join Wanda for her presentation.
My name is Wanda Diefeldt, and I'm from Brazil. I'm a Lutheran pastor. I'm a professor of theology at the Lutheran Seminary in the city of São Leopoldo, which is in the southern part of Brazil. And our subject today is church and politics. And I, of course, can speak primarily of the relationship of church and politics in Brazil, Latin America. But this morning I would like to start a session from the other end and lifting a few of the questions and a few of the observations that you have about what is the relationship between church and politics in your own experience. And if we say church and politics, what comes to your mind? So I would like to start from that perspective and then share my own experience of church and politics, and then we can come to a fruitful dialogue at the end of the session. So, church and politics, what does that have to say to you? Don't speak all at once, you know.
I'll just use one word, abortion.
Abortion. You want to expand on that?
No.
No?
I think of Jerry Falwell and Jesse Jackson. Opposite ends.
What else comes to your mind?
Are you speaking of church politics too?
Okay.
You know, church the politics in the church, that's mighty big issue.
You care to expand on that?
Well, I'm Catholic, and I just see that, you know, the lay people are coming into their own a bit, but certainly has a long way to go.
Mm-hmm. Give me a brief overview. What we're doing again? I missed the first sentence.
I want to start the session from the other way around. Instead of having me doing all the exposure and explaining from a Brazilian Latin American perspective about the relationship between church and politics, I would like to start from the other perspective and seeing what comes to your mind when the phrasing church and politics arises.
Rules.
Rules.
You can't do this or you can't do that. This is the right way to do this or the wrong way. This is our way or the highway type thing, where dogma, I guess, maybe would be a better word for it.
Mandating values. When the church gets involved in secular politics, sometimes the values that we develop as the people of God are institutionalized. Mm-hmm. And that goes with what Rick was saying, where it's you can't do this, you can't do that, this is good, this is bad.
Mm-hmm.
And that becomes institutionalized in the secular government.
Okay. I think of the fundamentalist or the right-wing party, the Republican Party has attempted to influence the party politics and also influence actions that are taken in Congress.
I think one other area is faith-based charity or welfare that has been expounded by giving money to government, money to these various charities, church charities.
Mm-hmm.
It's totally gone.
guess the school voucher thing is another.
What?
School vouchers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Usually a debate whether or not there's separation between, or should there be a separation between church and state.
I often also think of back how the current political leaders today will refer back to the founding fathers as people who were very, very Christian, quote unquote Christian, when in fact they were fighting revolution and they used Christian principles to base the country, but it wasn't. They made sure that they developed that church and state that you were talking about a second ago.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I thought you were waving at me, Mitchell.
Yeah, I was waving a flyer.
Well, maybe we should ask that fly if it has something to say about that subject.
Yeah, he was buzzing.
Well, I want to share a few observations from our reality in Brazil, in Latin America, and maybe you'll find some striking differences, but also some similarities. First, let me make an observation that the issue of church and politics is not something recent. We find this to be a very contemporary subject, especially in the church discussion, as we talk about the public policies that are developed by governments, and we do have that idea of democratic governments. But come to think about it, the relationship between church and politics, between Christianity and political governments, was there since the beginning of Christianity itself. And our New Testament professor here could probably give a whole lecture on that and do it beautifully, explaining how Jesus himself was confronted with Roman rulership and how should the Jews deal with the Roman Empire. And many times the observation, you know, give to Caesar what is of Caesar, has been misinterpreted as meaning, well, church people, Christian people, those who follow Jesus' movement ought to have nothing to do with a government, with politics, with the economic context in which we live. Well, I affirm that in reading the biblical text, that passage has been awfully misinterpreted as to say, well, Christians ought to be more concerned with the spiritual life, with the saving of souls, and not so much with what happens in our everyday lives. And it's interesting that Christianity had always been a persecuted religion. You know, from the witnesses of the martyrs already in the first centuries, about the persecutions that they suffered for standing up for values that were over against culture, over against society. And the baptismal formula of that Paul wrote down in his Galatians letter, Galatians 3, 26, 27, in which he quotes a formula that was used in baptizing, that in Christ there is neither Greek nor Jew, there is no slave and free, there is no male and female, because we are one in Jesus. Well, by saying that at baptism, Christianity was taking a very clear political stance, saying even if society discriminates on the basis of what culture you are, on the class you belong to, which gender you appear in. Even if society has a whole system of stratification, in the church it will not be that way. And that is already a political stance in saying, well, we are over against the discrimination, the oppression, the exclusion that happens in society. And that is a public statement when it is done in a baptism. Well, Christianity was persecuted for defending values, and values that affirm
human dignity, humans' capacity for development, in affirming that human beings are created in the image of God, something that Christianity has learned from Judaism. What happens with Constantine when the church and the Christian movement is no longer a persecuted religion, but it becomes a religion of the state itself? And here we have an influence that will change dramatically the way that we perceive ourselves as Christians and how we deal with society and how we deal with politics. Because ever since Constantine, in the 3rd century, what happened was that Christianity became the official religion of the empire. And that meant to say, well, whenever the Roman Empire, whenever the European context was under threat, Christianity was under threat as well. Whether it be against the Moors that were moving over, the barbarians, or you name it. Christianity was the official religion of this state. And that has a very important influence in the way that we perceive the relationship between church and state nowadays in Latin America and primarily in Brazil. Christianity came to the colonized world, to the Americas that were conquered by Christopher Columbus, or in the Spanish world, or by Pedro Álvares Cabral in the Portuguese world, because Brazil was colonized by the Portuguese and not by the Spanish. That meant to say that Christianity came with those that conquered the land. And it came defending, very different from what happened in the northern part of the continent, in North America, Canada. But in Spanish and Portuguese setting, Christianity came with the sword in one hand and the cross in the other hand. So meaning to say the distinction between state and church was not at all present, because both of them were part of the same body, so the cross and the sword. And that has a very important influence in the way Christianity, and primarily then Roman Catholicism, which was the official religion in our continent up until the 19th century, the only religion, so to say, in which church and state were hand in hand, the same way as the cross and the sword were hand in hand. The church was used primarily to justify the actions of the state. It was there to bless, to put the sign of the cross on whatever activity the colonizers were doing. And you know, the principle of colonization in Latin America was quite different from the one in Northern America. You learn that in your history lessons, and when you talk about how the colonies were, for instance, split up among the conquerors themselves. The crown, both the Spanish and the Portuguese, they were fighting over which of the two crowns ought to have the majority of the land. So it was arbitrarily decided, you know, that one part of the continent should belong to Portugal, and another part of the continent belonged to the Spanish crown in the Tordesillas treaty that was that more or less divided what nowadays is Brazil and what would be Spanish America. And the land, the plots of land were given to regional governors. And under these governors were then representatives of the crown. And each governor had on his side also a bishop, had a main priest who was there to sanctify, to bless whatever action was taken by the crown. And that has meant a very tragic history in our continent, because, and here, yes, we do share a similar story of pain, when that meant already in the 16th century, the enslavement of the indigenous people. They were used as cheap labor, and it was said since the indigenous people, the native people, were considered by the Spanish-Portuguese crowns as being subhuman, as human beings that were not to their full development yet, Christianity would be that step up that would help the indigenous population to become human. And that baptism by fire meant that then they would become as noble as the rest of the Europeans. Well, of course, that was done through hardship, through enslavement, through forced labor, displacement of the indigenous populations, because all of the land was taken to be now the land of the Spanish and of the Portuguese crown. And that's a very sad chapter of our history. And the sad story continues when the indigenous population rebelled against this type of use of their culture, of their labor force, and they fled more and more towards the inland. And it was a massive massacre of the indigenous population, because they were dying of diseases brought by the Europeans. They were tortured to death. They were decimated. And then the fields, the sugarcane plantations, and the mines, they could not work only with the European people that had come to just supervise and take the riches from the Americas back to Europe. And that means that then the slaves from Africa were brought in. And the history of slavery in Brazil finished only in the 19th century. So for almost three centuries, Africans were brought, they were captured in the continent and were brought forcibly in ships, both to Portuguese and Spanish countries. Brazil nowadays, due to that history, has one of the largest Afro-Brazilian populations. More or less half the population is of African descendants, even though the government attempted to decimate many of the people of African descendants. So this is very sad, it's even more so, in my opinion, when you come to think that in the ship that brought the slaves from Africa to Brazil, for instance, the slaves were already baptized in the ship itself. They were Christians. I mean, to say now they were promoted to being human, because Christianity was the entrance door to humanity. And I mean to say they had to be put into forced labor, they had to work hard, they had to pay for all of their sins by serving to a white master. And that would mean that their soul would be saved by punishing their physical body. And I think it's really a dreadful chapter of our history, and it's also a very dreadful chapter in the history of Christianity. Come to think about it, when we celebrated the 500 years of the conquest of the Americas, it was very meaningful that all over Latin America, that celebration in the Spanish America happened in 1992, and in Brazil it happened in the year 2000, because Pedro Álvares Cabral got lost in Brazil in the year 1500. We joke about that. He never really meant to come to Brazil. He was trying to find his way around and go to India instead. But, you know, it's like, that's why we joke about the colonizers have a very poor sense of direction, so that's why they got lost in Brazil. But meaning to say that in the year 2000 in Brazil, and in the year 1992 in all of the other Spanish-speaking countries, there were huge celebrations, and among those celebrations also public acts of repentance on the part of the Roman Catholic Church for all the ill doings towards slaves, towards the indigenous population. And I think it was like a public repentance, asking publicly a forgiveness for what had been done. Can I just make a side comment? So in the year 2000, that official celebration happened in the first place where the Portuguese arrived, which was in the port of Salvador in Bahia. And as all the bishops walked down the aisle and all the people came in, and were like thousands and thousands and thousands of people. And one of the Brazilian cardinals then made this speech about repentance and asking for forgiveness. And everybody was hoping then that the indigenous representative would come say, yes, I forgive you. And the indigenous representative said, no, I will not forgive you, because to forgive is to forget, and you never want to forget. And that was like, whoa, you know, because everybody thinks, oh yeah, you know, like now just because the church makes such a public statement that everything will be corrected. It's like, no, it's not that easy, because there's so much discrimination and massacre still going on nowadays that it needs to be registered as a public protest again. Yes, Susan?
Can you just go over the theology again about this baptism of fire and the baptizing of the slaves, and then that business of becoming human and working off your sin?
What you can find, and it's quite interesting to see the writings in colonial history, in both in Brazil and in the rest of Latin America. We tend to now go back to the holdings of Bartolomé de las Casas or other people like Toribio Cabeça de Vaca, who have been very strong opponents of this colonizing theology and have defended the rights of indigenous people and thereafter also of those brought from Africa. But the core of this theology was is developed by Aristotelian theology, philosophy, Aristotelian philosophy. And Aristotle says that cultures are defined by hierarchical positions. What characterizes a culture is you have leadership, you have a stratification. There are people who are supposed to be doing certain roles in society. So you have those who think, those who make war, those who serve, those who obey, and that type of pyramid type of system was a key for identifying what is culture in Latin America. Well, there is one author that writes very well about that called Tsvetan Todorov. I don't know how you pronounce that in English, but he tries to interpret how did this philosophy then apply also to a theology. The philosophy was the way that the colonizers first interpreted who would be equitable partners in dialogue. So if you notice it nowadays in Latin American history, cultures were the Mayas, the Aztecans, and the Incas, because they have a very clear order for society. If you come to think of the Aztecs, for instance, you would have a ruler, you would have the soldiers, you would have the priests, you would have the slaves, you would have those that are conquered by the others who will then be the subjects to this culture. Whereas in Brazil, they said these people have no culture whatsoever, because they have one leader, and the leader, you know, it changes leadership, and if people want to follow that leader, they follow him. If not, you know, they will do something else, and their society is not structured, there is no chain of command, and even the religious leaders, they just go and make their hocus pocus, and it's not in the same system of priesthood that the other cultures develop. Well, in applying that philosophy and anthropological understanding then to theology, it was quite interesting that the that the crown would use Christianity as a way of domesticating, so to say, the indigenous population by bringing them then from their own places into compounds that were of forced labor then organized by the Portuguese. And it was seen, honestly, by many of the Portuguese. They were doing a good work for God by bringing all of these heathens to convert Christianity. And how that had to be done. It's like by will or by force. I mean, if they are willing to convert to Christianity because their soul needs to be saved, otherwise they will burn in hell forever, they need to be brought to Christianity. And you'll find parallels in many of the mission movements, you know, going up to the 19th century. You know, you have to convert these people to Christianity, otherwise they will burn in hell forever. So we are doing a good job if we can do it by force. Now, Roman Catholicism is very different from the Protestant way that you have learned in your history in this country. In Roman Catholicism, it was baptism itself that would save. So it's the ritual. It's the fact that you have been baptized. And Christianity was forced upon all the people. It was not willingly so. They were brought in the ships and they were baptized en masse, you know, as part of that way of understanding Christianity as a way, as the only way to salvation. And that has a very interesting consequence that since people were forced into Christianity, it was never a conversion of a full heart, because this Christianity has always represented the religion of the oppressors. You can make parallels in the United States, in which people were drawn to Christianity because it was many of the African slaves were actually prevented from entering Christianity, which has led to a whole different situation. But in Latin America, the indigenous people and the African people, they kept their own religiosity. On the surface, they would say, we go to mass and we venerate the saints, we do everything, but they would turn them back and just continue practicing their own religiosity. And that's why nowadays Brazil is such a fascinating place for people to do research, because you find pretty much the same religious expression of the Yoruba, how do you pronounce it? Yoruba, that's why we say in Nigeria, and what we have nowadays in Brazil, in the Afro-American or Afro-Brazilian religions. The dances, the spirits that come upon people, the drums, and the life, the liturgy, that is, it's very, very similar. So 400 years, 500 years thereafter, you'd find the same rituals going from generation to generation. Something quite different in this country, where you almost don't see any of the African ethnic religions being practiced. But I want to point that out, just a second. I want to point that out because up to the 19th century, Roman Catholicism was the only official religion in the whole of Latin America. Nothing else existed. Yes.
It reminds me of the Spanish Inquisition attempting to force the Jews to become Christians and burning them if they didn't. And that preceded this, I think, preceded the attempt to Catholicize the world.
Yeah. Well, Inquisition was very strong in Latin America as well. But what happened, and for instance, one of the reasons why people were brought to Inquisition in Latin America, for instance, if you go to Colombia and you go to Cartagena, which is one of the official ports, you would have trials of the Inquisition, because one of the things that the pirates would bring
and would smuggle in were Bibles. And Bibles were things that could not be sold, and people were not allowed to have Bibles. You know, in a Roman Catholic setting, to have a Bible was considered something forbidden. So several people were brought to the Inquisition, not only for being accused of being Jewish, and many of the Jewish people fled from Europe and came to the Americas. We have a very strong Jewish population, which interestingly enough is not very prone to, they're not Zionists. They say, well, this is our land. Besides that, accusations of witchcraft and the accusations of those of slave descendants, both African or indigenous, who would practice their own rituals, they were also brought. But cases like this of smugglers who would bring in Bibles, something that was considered like too Protestant. What happened in the 19th century, and here's a shift in the history of Brazil, in particular, is with all the developments already going on in the industrialized world, you know, we're talking about 19th century, the Industrial Revolution, and the Brazilian emperor, Dom Pedro the II, he wanted to bring in Protestant people because Protestantism was considered to be a road to development. Those countries that were Protestant, such as the United States, but primarily England, were at the forefront of industrialization. And so why would Brazil always be such a backward country? So they thought, let's bring in Protestants, let's bring in people of white skin to counterbalance, you know, the increase, the dramatic increase in the African population. So the immigrants were brought in. And this is the similarity also with the history of this country, in which there was a terrible famine in Europe in the beginning of the 19th century, especially in the 1820s. And many, many people, many of your ancestors fled from Poland, from Germany, from Denmark, and came to the Americas. And it's interesting that people would come to the port, and then one ship would go to the United States, and one ship would come to Brazil. One ship would go to the United States, and the next one to Brazil. So I could have ended up here, come to think about it. But that's interesting for you to understand the large number of people who came to Brazil, Polish, Russian, Germans, not of the Iberian Peninsula. And immigrants were sent to those areas, the frontier areas, especially in the southern part of Brazil, to assure the borders between Brazil and Uruguay, Brazil and Argentina, Brazil and Paraguay. So these were like way in the jungle. What happened was the colonizing principle was such that not one single colony was allotted to only one ethnic group. So you would have a German colony here, next to it you would have an Italian colony, and next to it you would have a Portuguese colony, so that none of these colonies would create their own countries. Like, can you imagine a little Poland or a little Russia or something like that? So, and people would not be able to communicate among themselves until the 1960s. What that has to do with politics is the following. All throughout the 19th century in Brazil, Roman Catholicism was still the official religion. And for those immigrants that came and were Protestants, even though it was interesting to have Protestants because of our work ethics, you know, Max Weber talks about that, we were not allowed to the freedom of religious expression. Only in the beginning of the 20th century was Protestantism allowed as a religion in Brazil. What happened in the 19th century is the immigrants, especially the ones of Lutheran background, because Lutheranism in Brazil is a denomination of
transplantation. We were transplanted from one continent to the next. It's not the result of mission, which is something different. And these immigrants have a very strong idea that education was necessary. And so the first thing that they built after they had built their own shacks and cleared out the plots of land to start farming was to build a schoolhouse. And the schoolhouse was also used as a church on weekends. Now, the schoolhouse could not have a tower and could not have a bell and could not have a cross outside, because that would identify it as a church. So it had to be a schoolhouse. The government allowed that. And the cross could only be inside the schoolhouse, but nothing publicly stated. And only, actually, in the 1920s were the first churches built in Brazil, because then Brazil became a republic, and as such, the separation between church and state was assumed. The changes that I would like to point out also in the way that theology has been developed and the way we perceive how the political involvement of the churches. Well, ever since the beginning of the 20th century, also many missionaries came to Brazil, and from the Presbyterian tradition and from the Methodist tradition, and also many Pentecostals and Anglicans. All of these are the result of mission. The Lutheran tradition is the only one that came with the immigrants themselves. So it's a different history that we have in Brazil. That meant also an opening to different ways of being Christian in Latin America, and it more or less questioned the way Christianity had been presented solely by Roman Catholicism. All throughout the 20th century, the involvement between church and politics has been very much politics as a politics of the government. You can perceive that still nowadays, when a very strong faction of Roman Catholic bishops will still side with whatever the official policy of the government is. In many ways, disagreeing with the advancements that have happened in civil society, for instance, in the issue, I will not deal with the issue of abortion, but will deal with the issue of contraceptives, for instance. You know that Roman Catholicism says that any sexual relationship that does not aim at procreation is sinful. And because human beings ought to have sexual intercourse for the continuity of the species. Well, the Brazilian government will not say that and will develop many programs that distribute not only birth control methods, but also go public in this HIV age and say, well, use condoms. And well, the Roman Catholic Church will say, well, this is not our policy, but can no longer interfere in what the government does. Because since the Republic and since many other denominations have also come into play, the Roman Catholic Church has somehow lost its power in the Brazilian setting. But I think primarily in the 1960s, when the military dictatorship was came about in Brazil, it was 1964 until 1985, we lived under military dictatorship, is that a more representative sector of the Roman Catholic Church also dissented from the official rhetoric that Roman Catholicism had and started engaging in a very strong ecumenical movement. Meaning to say there were issues that were of common concern, not only to Roman Catholics, but to Christians in general. Issues of torture, issues of poverty, issues of social exclusion, discrimination, the well-being of children, issues of homelessness, which pulled together. And I think that that is a very strong ecumenical sign. The involvement of the churches also in awareness and social awareness was represented by the creation of a National Council of Churches, which is called CONIC, Conselho Nacional de Igrejas Cristãs, which has brought together the Roman Catholic Church, the Protestant Church, the Anglican, Presbyterian, Methodist, the Orthodox, and for some years also one of the Pentecostal churches. And I think that's very significant because in that sense the National Council of Churches has represented a counter voice also in the years of military dictatorship. Now, I asked you beforehand what you thought about church and politics, and most of us tend to think about politics as either party politics and say, well, is the church a place where party politics is happening? Or we think about politicians themselves, because, you know, this is year of election in Brazil. We are voting from for president, for governor, for Senate, and we are doing, this is a major year for political discussions. And you know, and I know how it is interesting for political candidates to come to churches and, you know, greet everybody they have never met or seen before and pretend, you know, they're best friends with everybody. And in some of the neo-Pentecostal churches, it works like such that if a pastor tells it's his flock to vote for that candidate, he will have at least 100 to 200 people voting for him. So it's very good to promise things to the pastors, like, okay, if you vote for me, I'll just pave all this sidewalk for you. And, you know, it's like this system of give and take that has always characterized the Brazilian politics, which actually corruption is what you see the most. What I find interesting, what I think is important to share, is how this ecumenical movement has shifted the notion of politics, not to mean only party politics or to discuss the policies that are developed by particular candidates, but to change the notion that every human being is a political being. And I think that is something quite crucial, that everybody is a political being. That by the fact that we interact among each other, whatever subject we talk, if we do it from a Christian perspective, from a Muslim, from an Afro-Brazilian, from whichever perspective, it does have political implications. Not only for parties, not only for the government, but politics mean to say that which deals with the common good, that which deals with the resources that we have at hand, that which deals with the way we deal with one another as human beings. And that has been summed up at least by social movements and by the ecumenical movement in Brazil with the notion of citizenship. Well, you have a long tradition of democratic government, and I don't think you have ever changed your constitution. Can you imagine changing the "we the people" constitution? Brazilian constitution has changed at least 20 times, and we just had a new constitution put in 1988-89. So we change our laws all the time. I mean, it's like we don't even write it on stone anymore because, you know, it's like things will not last. And because politics is the way that people will express, I think you pretty much live under the idea, well, once it is set as a standard, once it's constitution, once it's the rule, people will follow by it. It's like the democratic exercise. I have my rights, and my rights are assured. I have to comply with these regulations, but, you know, if things do not happen, then I will be able to have my rights restored to me. Well, in Latin America, we have always lived, common people have always lived with the idea that the law is not for us. It does not serve us. Laws are made to defend the rights of those who have. It's the way to assure government is the means by which the haves will prevent the have-nots from coming to the same situation as they are. And that is 500 years of history, and you cannot just change it, you know, with a snap of your fingers. So how important it is for Christianity to say, well, maybe we should deal a little bit more towards, like, everybody is a political being, that we can make a difference in whichever setting we are. We can take initiatives, and it's also our responsibility. It's a gift, and it's a responsibility that we have towards changing the society in which we are. It's not God-given that 10% of the population will own 90% of the wealth of the country. This is not God-given, but that was a misinterpretation, that was wrong, that was the political powers and the religious powers benefiting from the same injustices. And how can the churches nowadays deal with all of that? And I think the very concrete manifestation that we see nowadays is, for instance, if you go to any organization of landless peasants, because the access to land is one of the largest social problems that we face in Brazil nowadays, you will see that there are representatives of the church participating in this landless peasants. Not because the churches say, well, you know, we should be there to give a blessing, but because we realize that people who are explored, people who are landless, people who are dispossessed, are the very members of our congregations. It is our duty to be there with them, because these are the people of faith that we are supposed to be helping out in this situation. So we are not talking about a different movement outside of the church, but we are talking about the church itself being these people. The church is not only those who are rich. The church, the majority of the members of the churches are people of very limited resources. And talking about labor unions, neighborhood associations, the whole social networking of jobless persons, and how important it is to have for these social groups, organized groups, to know that they will find a pastor, they will find a priest that will help them in their journey to search for a more dignified life in whichever context they are. And one of the examples, and I would like to check your knowledge about this, is a movement called World Social Forum. Have you heard of this? And here I want to come into another thing, which we are facing very strongly in Brazil, which is the dictatorship of the media nowadays. It's like we have, I mentioned the other day, we had in the last assembly of the Christian based communities, we had about 10,000 people, and there was no media coverage for any of that. And how the media can show facts that are only one-sided. All you have, I have seen this in the past week when Susan was talking about the situation in Palestine, West Bank, and Israel. But here I want to show to you maybe a bias that exists about what the new initiatives are. And that initiative comes with a very strong support of the churches as well. The World Social Forum happened, the first edition happened 2 years ago. This year we had the second one, and the third one is going to happen next year. And it happens in the city of Porto Alegre. Porto Alegre, in the southern part of Brazil, is the capital of the state. And it is a place that has had a popular democratic administration for the past 15 years. And the churches have been very important in helping precisely this consciousness raising about citizenship, about the fact that everybody is a political being, helping its own members to become more aware of what the options for election are. No church in the ecumenical setting will tell its member, vote for that party or that candidate. That is not admissible. What happens is, what would be the criteria for electing a person for an office? Asking for ethics, asking for what proposal this person has, and what the type of history the person has in the community itself. And these, just help people to be aware of the power people have when electing somebody into office. The World Social Forum is a movement that started precisely with this notion that what is happening in one part of the world is also happening in different parts of the world. And a French newspaper called Le Monde, have you heard of this newspaper? Okay. It's one of the sponsors of this annual forum. Last year, this year in the beginning of February, it meets for about a week, 60,000 people gathered for this World Social Forum. People from all over the world came to the city of Porto Alegre and pointing out what would be new alternatives for the economics, for ecology, for the rights of children, for the rights of the native people. And it's a huge forum bringing together representatives, anybody who wants to come to participate and see what are the world leaders discussing about global warming, or talking about more just distribution of land, and what are the policies. And so there are all these workshops and sessions. It's like this gigantic university that meets, and all these big shot artists that come and say, you know, what their movies or what their paintings, what type of difference they make. Like people like Steven Spielberg has come to Brazil and said, well, you know, what that. And I find it fascinating that everybody I ask from the United States, nobody has heard about that. Can you imagine, like, 60,000 people meeting to discuss the future of the planet, and world leaders, and artists, and intellectuals, and church people, and everybody mixed together, and talking about what are the issues that we are discussing. And it's like, how interesting. So many people from the United States, you know? And those who do come are considered to be completely at the fringe of what they're doing. The key speaker in the last forum was Noam Chomsky.
Oh.
So I find it fascinating, you know, that people don't know about this initiative that started as being what can happen when the churches come together, when different political parties come together, when labor unions, neighborhood associations, and even our small group of theologians. I mean, we go there, we have our sessions, and we talk about interreligious dialogue. We talk about September 11 and what are the effects of the global militarization. But apparently, we are talking to ourselves. People like you don't know about it, and I think you would be so knowledgeable about these things. So, I want to extend the invitation. Come to Brazil next year. Because after that, it's going to be in India for the next 3 years. And it stays in one country for a number of years, and then now it's going to go to India next year. But still next year in Brazil.
Is there any attempt to reach consensus on some of these issues? In other words, is there an end product? Would the group make a decision to move in a certain way or to promote certain values?
Yeah. Maybe I should, the dates for this forum always coincide with the Davos meeting that happens in Switzerland. You have heard about that one, you know, it's like the big economic leaders of the world meet in this town in Switzerland for a week, and they discuss about, you know, what's the future of IMF and World Bank, and that's why this started. It's like this big gathering of people who challenge the IMF, World Bank, and all of the economic situation that we have nowadays. And it started as being an anti-Davos gathering. And it's very interesting because at one point in both of the meetings, the representative, one representative of a group of representatives of the World Social Forum will have a dialogue. It's like this, how did this technology that allows for simultaneous discussion? And so, and a representative from the Davos gathering. So both of them discussing what this group is proposing, you know, the World Bank, IMF, and all the people, you know, and what this popular group wants to, you know, what is at stake, and then ethics and joblessness and ecology. So it is quite interesting to see, because the repercussion that 60,000 people meeting in one place, people who would take a week of their year and just go there and protest and present alternatives. I think that's very fascinating. But interestingly enough, because there is such a variety of initiatives, the forum has never aimed at saying, well, now we will go the way of this party or this initiative. It's really a celebration of the multiplicity of initiatives that exist and that ought to be celebrated, and uplifting whichever grassroots movement there is, whichever small group that makes a difference in other people's lives, that assures the well-being of the planet, that affirms dignity of human life, that creates new jobs and new economic alternatives, and all of that is really a big celebration. And people go there to learn new things. People want to see, well, see, this group in Thailand has this project, you know, how we could do that in our context as well. So it's really creating new networks of communication and networks of alternative lifestyle as well. And I think Holden should have its own stand there, you know, it's like that. Holden should have a workshop and say, you know, what is this all about? You know, why is it that all these people have a political difference? Because as soon as your lifestyle is not the lifestyle of everybody else, you're making a political stance. It's not necessarily a political party, it's not necessarily deciding the policies of your government, but you do make a political stance, which whatever you say, whatever you do. And if Holden does promote that, you know, why not go there and share it with the worldwide? So that would be.
Do we get a mailing list or something?
There is a website. It's World Social Forum. It's, just look for it. It's there, and it has all the alternatives and things like that. So, oh yeah, and by the way, if you come, February, January is summertime in Brazil. The beaches are beautiful. It's great for surfing. So. Any other questions or comments? Time is up. Well, thanks to the tape producer, we are done with the session. If anybody wants to talk about this outside the session, I'd be welcome.
Thank you for that.
Thank you.
Great.